Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are jumping into a massive stack of research on a figure who is usually called the grandfather of modern political philosophy.
Right, Thomas Hobbes.
Yeah. But honestly, looking through all these sources we have today, he feels a lot more like the grandfather of a dystopian sci-fi novel.
That is a surprisingly accurate description. I mean, he really is the original architect of the machine state.
And the sources are so fascinating because they don't just present him as some dusty academic in a wig. They paint a picture of a man who was absolutely obsessed, like physically and mentally obsessed with one specific primal emotion.
Fear.
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 And not just as an abstract concept, it was a lived experience for him.
It's the defining feature of his life. And to really understand Leviathan, which is the big book everyone knows him for, you have to understand that it wasn't written in a vacuum. It was written by a man who was quite literally scared out of his mind from day one.
The anecdote that really stuck with me from the reading is the story of his birth, because it sets the stage so perfectly. It's 1588, which is a massive year in English history.
The year of the Spanish Armada.
Right. You have this massive fleet of invasion ships spotted off the coast. England is in a state of absolute panic. And Hobbes's mother is apparently so terrified by the news that she goes into labor prematurely.
Leading to that famous line, Hobbes actually wrote about himself later in life where he said, "Fear and I were born twins."
Fear and I were born twins. That is just such a heavy way to view your own existence. It sounds like a line from a Batman villain.
It really does. But it's the key that unlocks his entire philosophy. Our mission today, for you listening, is to unpack how that fear drove him to try and solve the problem of human nature. But here's the twist. He didn't try to solve it with religion or poetry or, you know, moralizing.
Right, all the tools people usually use in the 1600s.
Exactly. He tried to solve it with physics.
And that's the part I want to really dig into because it seems so counterintuitive. We usually think of political philosophy as being about ideals, justice, freedom, human rights. But Hobbes looks at politics and he just sees mechanics.
He sees a machine. And that brings us to the core tension of his time. We are in the 17th century. For hundreds of years, the answer to the question of why is the king in charge was simple. The divine right of kings. God said so.
But that answer was failing.
It was collapsing violently. Hobbes lived a very long life right through the English Civil War in the 1640s. He watched his country basically tear itself apart over religion and politics.
Because if you and I disagree on what God wants and we both have swords, there is no referee.
Precisely. He realized that saying God put the king there wasn't enough to stop people from killing each other anymore. And Hobbes hated that sectarian conflict. He was a royalist who supported the king, but he had sympathies with what was called the broad church tradition.
Meaning he wanted to minimize those intense religious arguments.
Yeah, he saw them as the primary fuel for civil war and anarchy. So he realizes he needs a totally new argument for authority. One that doesn't rely on faith, but on something undeniable. He needs to ground politics in the one thing he thinks is absolute reality, matter and motion.
So let's walk through this because the sources lay out a really specific chain of logic here. He starts with the universe, then moves to the human body, then the human mind, and finally society. It's like he is building a bridge.
Or dissecting a corpse. He was heavily influenced by the scientific revolution happening around him. He knew Francis Bacon, who was all about inductive science and observation. He actually even met Galileo.
Wow.
Yeah. And he adopted this method called resolution and composition.
Which is basically taking a watch apart to see how the gears work.
Yeah.
And then putting it back together in a logical order.
Right. But he applied that to society. He thought, if I want to understand why we have civil wars, I need to break society down into its smallest parts.
And the smallest part of society is a human being.
And the smallest part of human being is matter, physics. This is his commitment to methodological naturalism, the radical idea that there is no magic, there are no spirits, there is only cause and effect. Everything, literally everything, is a result of causal processes.
This is where the unity of sciences comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the same laws that apply to astronomy and physics should apply to psychology and politics.
That's it. It's a radical materialism. He believed that everything is just bodies in motion. A billiard ball hits another ball that is motion, light hits your eye that is motion. That motion travels to your brain and creates a thought that is also just motion.
Okay, I have to stop you there because this has huge implications for the time period. If everything is just matter bumping into matter, was Hobbes an atheist? Mm-hmm. Because in the 1600s, that is a very dangerous thing to be.
It was incredibly dangerous and he was accused of it constantly. The sources are a bit nuanced here, though. He was likely a materialist who believed God was the first cause.
The guy who pushed the first domino.
Right. He even references Stoic traditions suggesting God might be a rarefied material being, like a very fine spirit, but still stuff, still matter. Because for Hobbes, if it isn't matter, it just doesn't exist.
But if we are just biological machines, why is religion so universal? If spirits aren't real in the physics sense, why do we all talk about them? Hobbes has to account for that.
He does, and he has a very clinical, almost cynical explanation for it. He calls it the seed of religion. And it comes back to, you guessed it, fear and curiosity.
We are curious machines.
Exactly. We see an effect like thunder or a plague, and we want to know the cause. So we ask, what caused that? And what caused the cause? Eventually, you hit a wall. You run out of visible causes.
So we invent an invisible one.
We assume there must be a first cause. We call that God. But Hobbes says this is driven by a fear of things invisible. We are scared of the dark. We are scared of the unknown. So our brain, this anxiety-ridden machine, projects agency onto the world to cope with it.
So religion isn't a divine phone call. It's a coping mechanism for a brain that is terrified of chaos.
In his view, yes. It is a product of the machine trying to make sense of the data it is receiving.
Speaking of data, I want to get into his theory of epistemology, how we actually know things. Because the blue shirt example in the notes really threw me for a loop. It seems simple, but it actually destroys the idea of objective reality.
It does. He starts with sensation. Sensation is just a physical object causing a change in our sense organs and brain. And this leads to the distinction between primary and secondary qualities.
So walk us through it. I am looking at a blue shirt. To me, the shirt is blue.
Okay. The shirt itself, the physical object out there in the world, has primary qualities. It has size, it has shape, it is moving or sitting still. Those things are real. They are physically in the shirt.
But the color blue.
The shirt is not blue.
It looks blue. I am seeing blue right now.
You are experiencing blue. The light bounces off the shirt, hits your retina, creates a physical pressure that travels to your brain, and your brain generates the image of blue. The blueness is a secondary quality. It exists only in your head.
So the world outside of us is actually silent, colorless, and odorless.
Just matter and motion. The color, sound, and smell are just the user interface your brain creates.
That is alienating. It makes you feel very alone in your own head.
It really is. And it leads directly to his view on imagination. We like to think imagination is this divine spark of creativity. Hobbes says no. Imagination is just decaying sense.
Decaying sense. It sounds like a death metal album, but what does it actually mean?
Think of a bell. You strike a bell and it rings. When you stop striking, it does the sound stop immediately.
No, it hums. It fades out over time.
That hum is imagination. It is just the after image of a sensation you already had. So when you imagine a fairy giraffe with butterfly wings, you aren't creating anything new.
I'm just taking the old file for giraffe and the old file for butterfly and photoshopping them together.
Exactly. It is data processing. It is a jumbled file system of old sensory inputs left over from sensation.
He really strips the magic out of being human.
Yeah.
And he does the exact same thing with language, right? This nominalism concept.
This is crucial for his politics. Nominalism comes from the Latin for name. Hobbes argues that universals don't exist.
Give me an example of a universal.
Okay, take the concept of dog. There is no abstract universal reality of dogness floating in the universe. Only particular, specific physical dogs exist. Words are just names or labels we group together.
Got it.
And this applies to abstract concepts too, like the concept of good. We talk about good like it is a real thing we can all measure against. Hobbes says, absolutely not. There is no good. There is only what I personally desire.
And evil is just what I hate or have an aversion to.
Right. Words are just sticky notes we put on things to categorize them.
Yeah.
But because we all have different bodies and different desires, my good might be your evil.
And that is a massive problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because if morality is subjective and just based on what I personally desire, how do we ever agree on anything?
No, you're seeing the trap. If we are machines driven by individual desires and there is no objective moral standard to settle our argument, conflict isn't just possible, it is inevitable.
This connects to his view on free will, doesn't it? Because I feel like I choose to be a good person. But Hobbes seems to think choice is another illusion.
He does. He believes consciousness itself is just an epiphenomenon.
Mean what exactly?
A byproduct of brain processes. You look at human action and you see a choice. He looks at it and sees a mechanism. You have the brain, which is the seat of thought in the calculator, and the heart, which he saw as the seat of desire and aversion. And he is very clear we are not driven by reason. We are driven by passion. by emotions.
Reason is just the scout for the passions. It just figures out how to get what we want.
Exactly. We are not free from cause and effect. So when you think you are making a choice, say, deliberating between two things, what is actually happening inside the machine?
I assume I am weighing the pros and cons.
Hobbes calls that deliberation, but he defines it as just the alternating succession of desires and aversions.
So it is a seesaw.
Yes. I want this, but I fear that. I want this other thing, but I fear the consequence. Back and forth.
And the choice itself.
It is simply the last desire that wins the seesaw battle before the action happens. The one that tipped the scale. He calls this soft determinism.
Meaning, I am free to do what I desire, but I'm not free to choose what I desire.
Correct. Your desires are determined by your biology and your environment. You are locked in.
This leads to a pretty grim conclusion about human motivation. Psychological egoism. Basically, we are wired to pursue self-interest all the time.
Yes, we are driven by a restless desire for power to ensure our survival. Even when we are being altruistic, Hobbes would say you are doing it because the feeling of being a good person gives you pleasure or relieves your anxiety. It always loops back to self-interest.
Okay, so let's look at the board we have set up here. We are biological machines.
Oh, we are selfish.
We are driven by fear.
Yeah.
We have no objective morality since my good is different from your good. And we are stuck on a planet with limited resources.
Welcome to the state of nature.
This is the famous war of all against all.
It is his grand thought experiment. Strip away the police, the government, the laws. What happens? It is a pure power struggle.
And life in this state is, as he famously put it, nasty, short, and brutish.
Because without a common power to keep us in awe, my desire for your land and my fear that you might kill me to get my land leads to a preemptive strike. I have to kill you before you kill me. It is the logical move for a survival machine.
It is the terrifying part. He is not saying we are evil demons. He is saying we are rational.
Yeah.
In that situation, attacking your neighbor is the smart thing to do.
Exactly. It is a prisoner's dilemma played out with swords.
So how do we get out? If we are programmed for this chaos naturally, how do we ever build a civilization?
We use that little calculator we talked about earlier, reason. Our right reason realizes that living in constant fear of being murdered is a terrible way to live. We want to live.
So that we can come up with natural laws.
But be careful, because unlike someone like Aquinas, who saw natural law as moral or teleological, Hobbes sees it as just right reason for survival. Rule number one, seek peace.
Because peace means self-preservation.
And rule number two, keep covenants. Keep your contracts. Because if we can't trust a deal, we are right back in the war. So to survive, we use our reason to make the ultimate deal, the social contract.
But this isn't the democratic social contract we usually think of, where we just agree to be nice and vote. We agree to surrender.
Yes. Hobbes argues that because our natural passions, our greed, our fear are so strong, a simple promise isn't enough. We need a monster to scare us into behaving.
The Leviathan.
We take all our individual authority, all our right to govern ourselves, and we hand it over to one absolute ruler, the Leviathan.
And this power has no limits.
It has absolute authority over civil matters and religious matters.
This is the Erastianism mentioned in the notes.
Right. The ruler decides how to interpret God's laws to prevent sectarian fighting. Because remember, Hobbes saw religious disagreement as the source of the Civil War. If you let people interpret religion themselves, they will find a reason to fight. So the Leviathan decides the official truth.
That is basically totalitarian. He is arguing for a dictator who controls your body and your spiritual life.
He is. But you have to ask yourself why. It is not because he loves tyrants. It is because he fears the alternative. To Hobbes, the worst tyranny is still better than the anarchy of the state of nature.
It is a protection racket. You pay with your freedom and you get safety in return.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one exception, right? One limit to this absolute authority.
Yes. You can resist only if the ruler tries to kill you.
Because the whole point of the contract was self-preservation.
Exactly. If the Leviathan comes to take your life, the contract is void for you. You can fight back. But until that moment, you obey.
There is a fascinating irony in the historical context here that we have to touch on. Hobbes was a royalist. He wanted the king back in power. But when he published Leviathan in 1651, the king had been executed. England was essentially under Oliver Cromwell, who was an absolute military ruler.
That is the brilliant twist of this whole thing. Leviathan was written while Hobbes was in exile, and it managed to anger everyone. The royalists hated it because Hobbes didn't say power came from God. He said it came from the people's consent, even if it was a forced consent for survival.
And the religious factions hated it because he made the church completely subservient to the state.
But interestingly, the theory could be read as an attempt to make peace with Cromwell.
Because it worked perfectly for him.
It did. Hobbes basically said, look, it doesn't matter if you have royal blood. It matters that you have the power to maintain order. If Cromwell is the one holding the sword that keeps the peace, then Cromwell is the Leviathan. You obey him.
It is incredibly pragmatic. It is the philosophy of a survivor who will do anything to avoid the chaos of war.
Absolutely.
So when we step back and look at this entire journey today, from the fear of the Spanish Armada to a mechanical view of the human brain, leading inevitably to the need for an absolute dictator to keep us from destroying each other.
Mm-hmm.
What is the big takeaway? Why does this matter to you, the listener, today?
I think the real power of Hobbes is that he teaches us that knowledge, specifically the knowledge of causes, is power. He demystified politics and treated it as an engineering problem. He showed us that if you understand the mechanism of human fear and desire, you can design a solution.
But the solution is terrifying. He essentially argues that we trade freedom for security because we are naturally selfish and dangerous.
And that is the final provocative thought he leaves us with. He wrote this hundreds of years ago. But look around.
Right.
When a crisis hits today, an economic collapse, a pandemic, a war, what is our instinct? The question for you is our modern desire for safety and order strictly a result of that same primal fear?
And does that fear still drive us to hand over power to modern leviathans today?
The physics of human nature might not have changed at all. The fear is still the same.
That is a chilling thought to end on. We like to think we have evolved past that nasty, short, and brutish life, but maybe the machine is still running the exact same software. Something for you to explore on your own. Thank you for helping us navigate the mind of Thomas Hobbes today.
My pleasure.
And to you, the listener, thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We will see you next time.